under advisement. And our next case for argument is Olensky v. Rossi, or Neil Rossi. Mr. Baker.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is James Baker. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Donald Olensky. This is a First Amendment case. Mr. Olensky, for many years, was a prison psychologist at the Jacksonville Correctional Center. His claim in this case is that he was a victim of retaliation because of activities he undertook in his capacity as a union official. The district court granted summary judgment. The briefs in this case are extensive. The facts are extensive. The order is extensive. I would like to focus this morning on three specific areas. The first is the district court's conclusion that much of Olensky's speech arose out of his duties as a prison psychologist and thus were barred in a First Amendment context by the Garcetti rule. The court in reaching
and the distinction you make between speaking as an employee and speaking as a union member, because as a union member, union officer, he's a representative of the employees. The employees are part of the company, and so suppose he's very concerned about safety, right? Well, that's a concern of the company also. Company may feel it less acutely than he does. But when he's urging safety on the company, seems to me, he is doing so as part of his responsibilities to the company.
I think we have to examine that issue in the context of the facts of this case. And I think
they throw him out because they don't like what he's saying. He has remedies under labor law, right?
Yes, but he also has First Amendment remedies.
Well, I don't understand that. If he has remedies under labor law, why do we have to get into the Constitution?
I think he has options under both labor law and...
I don't get that.
Well, Your Honor, I...
If he has, why don't we always want people to explore their statutory remedies before they drag the Constitution into a case?
I'm not sure that I can speak to that other than to say...
Why not?
Well, I'm a little confused. I think that this court has recognized in the past, and we've cited the cases in our brief, that activities undertaken in furtherance of union activities affect the collective rights of employees are protected by the First Amendment as a freedom of association and as a freedom of speech. Now, I would concede that Mr. Olensky may have had rights as well under a state statute regulating public employee labor relations. I'm not doubting that. But merely because he has those state remedies does not mean he's not also protected under the First Amendment.
Well, what do you think the logic of Garcetti is?
Beg your pardon?
What do you think the logic of Garcetti is?
Well, in my view...
That's not a rhetorical question. I don't understand it myself.
Well,
what do you think about...
I am not an exponent of the Garcetti view or the manner in which this court has applied the Garcetti principle. In my view, Garcetti is a very narrow case where if part of one's regular job duties is to issue a report or... make specific undertakings, and in furtherance of those undertakings, he engages in speech. That speech is an employee,
wasn't
not as
Garcetti,
a citizen.
Wasn't he worried about people being killed?
I don't recall if he was worried about people being killed. What I recall is he was giving a report in furtherance of his job as an assistant district attorney.
Yes, but he was concerned with safety.
You may have been. I don't.
Why is that any different from what your client is concerned?
Because of the context in which the speech was made. In Garcetti, the plaintiff was making a report which was a part of what he was supposed to do as an assistant district attorney. In this case, all of Alinsky's speech occurred within the context of his responsibilities as a union official.
I mean, that just seems like such an artificial and hyper-technical distinction.
I would disagree, Your Honor. I think it's a very real...
Social interest. I don't get it.
In my view, Garcetti was intended to have a very narrow application to speech which is rendered as a part of one's day-to-day job duties. And the Garcetti court said you can't stretch a person's job duties so that all of his speech is encompassed within his job duties. In this case, there is nothing in the duties of a prison psychologist that says he has to get involved in situations where an inmate assaults other security officers and there's need for more protection. In this case, his complaints about the hygiene practices of a dentist had nothing to do with his duties as a psychologist, and they were made in reaction to requests by union members.
You know, we often think of union. I suppose we normally think of unions and employers as antagonistic. But a lot of employers actually welcome unions, and they regard the union as providing a check on their supervisors, right? I mean, that's important. So I think there's a sense in which Alinsky is helping the prison when he points out these dangers to the psychologists because of their very lax security.
I would agree that he is both helping the members of his bargaining unit and the Department of Corrections. I have no fault with that. But I think taking that view to its logical conclusion, any time an employee speaks out on an issue which ultimately might benefit the employer, is he speaking pursuant to his job duties? I don't think Garcetti goes that far. I think it has a much narrower application and talks about what's part of your day-to-day job duties.
Okay, just one more question. I'm confused about the pager. Now, did he want to have the pager? It's connected with this overtime. That somehow, if he carries the pager, he gets additional compensation even if he isn't summoned to, you know, overtime work. Is that how it
The history of this situation is that for many years, when Alinsky was away from the prison and was paged because of an issue, he didn't always have to come into the prison. If he could deal with it by telephone, he received benefit time. And I can't recall if he received 1 hour or 2 hours of benefit time. And that had gone on for years and years, and I think had been resolved in Alinsky's favor when he first started with the prison. Warden Polk changed that policy. Alinsky objected to it.
There was no longer compensation if you didn't actually have to go into it.
My recollection of the details is kind of faint, but I think he might have been entitled to compensation only for when he came into the prison, but not on the telephone. In any event, Alinsky may have, I think he asked a question, if I don't get compensated for the time, do I still have to carry the pager? That's all he did. And Assistant Warden Rossi in his deposition acknowledged that Alinsky never refused to carry the pager, never expressed an unwillingness to carry it. And that kind of leads to my second area of discussion, which was the removal of Alinsky from NEMAT. And the district court's discussion of that issue was interesting in my view. It acknowledged that the removal from NEMAT could be kind of a harm protected under the First Amendment. It acknowledged that the defendant's reasons for removing him were confusing, but it said that they were entitled to qualified immunity because they thought he didn't want to carry a pager, and maybe they were mistaken in that respect, but it was a reasonable mistake. I won't get into the qualified immunity law, but suffice it to say that a reasonable jury could find that this was more than that.
Well, the district court never decided this issue, did it?
To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure after reading the opinion a number of times. It seems to suggest that they were justified because they thought he didn't want to carry a pager. That's what I make of its decision. And if I may just follow point, there are several things that I think need to be mentioned. The first is the removal was instigated by the warden with the assistance of the health care administrator and the assistant warden back in May of 2006, and it was done when there was a very acrimonious relationship between Olinsky and those people concerning three or four specific labor issues that he was advocating. The second point is, in their letters to the people that managed NEMAT, they really don't talk about the pager. They talk about other things. And as we explain in our brief, there are a lot of holes in what they were saying. And finally, there was never an unwillingness on Olinsky's part to carry the pager, and Assistant Warden Rossi acknowledged that. I see I have a red light, and I think my time is up.
We'll give you another minute.
Okay,
maybe when you rebut. Okay, we'll give you a little time to rebut.
Okay, thank you very much.
Siegel?
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Evan Siegel, on behalf of the defendant Neil Rossi and his colleagues. I want to launch right into Your Honor's point about this artificial distinction between union service and speaking as an employee. Indeed, Mr. Olinsky is helping the prison when he talks about security and safety issues. As a practical matter, we would find it very odd that a prison employee who saw, for instance, an open window or a broken jail door didn't bring that to the attention of his superiors to highlight security problems. Now, and of course, this court's case law on speech as an employee highlights the fact that one's obligation to speak goes beyond core job duties. It's sort of a common sense to touchstone. But I want to correct something that counsel said about and said in his reply brief to the point that Mr. Olinsky spoke exclusively and solely as a union member when he served on the Health and Safety Committee at the prison.
Well, he was a union officer. Why do you keep saying he's a union member?
You're right, Your Honor. He's a union officer and a member. He was promoted to that position.
Well, that gives him more responsibility, doesn't it?
It may. It may well. However, in 2001 and 2002, prior to his appointment as a union officer to the committee, his job duties specifically required him to participate on the Health and Safety Committee and to ensure safety and sanitation standards. This is 3 years before the appointment. This is found at document 1810 at pages 19, 26, and 27. And what that means is that those responsibilities that he had as a prison psychologist preceded his service as a union committee member, as a union officer. So his assignment to the committee, despite what counsel says, did not change his pre-existing duties. And that committee service did not transform every statement that he made into union-protected speech. Now, turning to a different subject, a related subject to the constitutional question as to whether the speech is protected by the First Amendment retaliation standards, regardless of whether any of Olinsky's communications were part of his expected job duties, he didn't show as a matter of content that he spoke on issues of public concern when it came to his complaints about trivial violations of the union agreement. That and security are the two topics, the two focal points of speech that counsel highlights in his brief. Now, the district court did not reach this issue, but this court can, of course, affirm for any reason in the record. And importantly, Alinsky has the burden of proof on this issue, and he did not address it in his opening brief. As a general matter, an issue of public concern speech has to relate to a matter of political, social, or other concern to the community. And that includes speech intended to reveal wrongdoing, about public actors, about shortcomings, misdeeds, things like fraud, corruption, breaches of the public trust. And also simply because speech relates to prisons categorically, that doesn't automatically place it within the confines of a matter of public concern. Also, importantly, union organizing activity, and by that I mean the formation of a union, is public concern speech under this court's decision in Gregorich. But that seems to be a bright line that this court has drawn. We have not been able to find any case where the court has held that disputes about interpretations of the union contract under Connick amounts to a matter of political, social, or other importance. Separately and critically as well, the public concern speech can't be something that's a private interest that vindicates or promotes somebody's personal agenda, unless, with one qualification, the individual is trying to help the public. But none of the speech here gets beyond satisfies these tests, because it's all about him personally and internal prison matters on these two topics of security and the labor contract. Now, Alinsky concedes in his reply brief, page 10, I believe, that anything having to do with his movements on two different occasions to the clinical services area of the facility is not something that he sees as involving retaliation. So that alleged harm is out. And that leaves us really with, from what we can tell from the brief, just one particular point in time in October of 2006 when he spoke about security lapses at a Health and Safety Committee meeting. But this speech really had to do merely with the ideal amount of background information that accompanied prisoners when they were coming into the prison for intake. This was not some sort of macro discussion about manpower problems or shortages or the proverbial broken windows and open doors. It's a matter of it's an issue of internal matters within the prison, and complaints elsewhere, from what we can tell, about not prisoners not receiving proper psychiatric care are really generic and specific, not specific and vague, but all of it is about internal policies. Connick makes clear, and this court's decisions interpreting it, that complaints about intra-office policies and procedures don't merit First Amendment protection. And that's what Mr. Alinsky's speech about prison intake is about.
Do you think it's really appropriate or possible to make a decision about qualified immunity in a summary judgment situation like this, where these matters are so involved with factual issues of one sort or another? I don't see how you can make that decision.
I do, Your Honor. Well, this court frequently grants qualified immunity in conjunction with summary judgment.
Well, sometimes you can, but I mean, this whole case has got so many factual aspects to it that I'm not sure you can hear.
Well, it has a lot of facts, and the record is enormous. But there's really none of the allegedly disputed facts, such as the pager issue, has any legal significance. Again, the speech at issue, we're talking about two confined areas, security, and the second one is labor, the labor issues relating to telepsychiatry. That doesn't satisfy the public concern standard either. What happened here is that Mr. Alinsky, for a period of time, worked in a different section of the prison, the healthcare unit, where he saw defendant Sudbrink and claimed he could see her literally violating the collective bargaining agreement and causing erosion to the union's position. But again, the Supreme Court has warned in Connick that courts risk becoming enmeshed in every sort of labor issue, if every employee grievance, which, as Your Honor pointed out, has remedies in other venues, rises to the level of constitutional significance. These internal prison matters are ideally suited for the labor dispute process and not judicial oversight. In sum, neither...
Well, is that recognized by any case as a defense? It's really a labor issue? It's not a constitutional issue?
I have not seen a case like that. In the first case, the court was grappling with what to do when there's a contemporaneous grievance and somebody complains as part of his public duties up the chain about the conduct of a police officer. And the court did not decide what to do in this hybrid situation, but that's distinct from our situation. We don't have that hybrid because, as I said a moment ago, the duties, the commonsensical duties to talk about security and safety were precursors to his appointment as an officer to the committee. Now, relatedly, the limiting principle on what sort of union activity is the line, if you will, when an issue about union issues arise to public concern seems to be the Grigorich case. It's the only one that we've seen. That involved an attempt by staff attorneys on the Illinois Appellate Court in Springfield to unionize, to obtain sick leave, I believe, benefits. And again, that initial unionization activity, the formation of a union, is protected under the First Amendment as a matter of public concern. But the day-to-day minutiae of paragraph-by-paragraph violations of a union contract, there's no support in this court's case law, from what I've been able to find, that that's public concern speech. So, ultimately...
If there ever was a case that was a hybrid, it seems to me it's this one. And then the trial judge kept saying that, didn't he?
The trial court
did. This is very confusing, and I can't figure this one out.
Yes, Your Honor. He did say there was overlap in certain areas, and the court didn't decide other areas, but this court is not bound by that reasoning. And we would urge the court to find that there is no hybrid because the job duties, commonsensical, and they also on paper preceded his appointment. Ultimately, Alinsky was a dissatisfied employee who complained frequently about his work life, but he didn't face any retaliation, and we'd ask the court to affirm the mm-hmm. district court. Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Mr. Baker, I'll give you another minute.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would like to make 3 points. The first point is Mr. Siegel's comments concerning Mr. Alinsky's membership on the Health and Safety Committee. And I think his point is that his job description back in 2001 said he was supposed to be on that committee, so it's not protected. What he fails to say is he was never appointed to that committee by management at JCC. When he was elected to a union office, he was delegated as the union's health and safety advocate, and he was appointed by the union to that committee. When he left the committee, it was not at the instance of JCC management, it was at the instance of the union. He went back to being a prison psychologist and never served on that committee thereafter. Second point is that
the arguments that the defendant makes and the end of his brief is that there's no real evidence that that there was retaliation, that the things he complains about don't seem to be connected to his speech. And you know, the office business, moved to another office.
Well,
there seem to be reasons for the office move that have nothing to do with what
there
he
were
said.
No reasons given by the defendants for the office move. Alinsky asked why he was being moved, and they refused to tell him. What we know is...
No, that's a separate point. The defendant says there's no evidence whether or not they explained anything to him, there's no evidence that the office move was retaliatory, that there were other reasons, you know, for for putting him there.
Okay, well, putting aside the fact that they really don't articulate those reasons.
Well, no, they do. In the end of at the end of the defendant's brief, they talk about these. They talk about these things, right?
Can I speak to what the evidence of retaliation is?
Yeah.
Mr. Alinsky was assigned to the health care unit where there was security protection available. He was the first union officer to ever work in that unit. The presiding official in the health care unit was a woman named Becky Sudbrink, who was the health care administrator. Mr. Alinsky noted that she was a serial violator of the collective bargaining agreement by taking away work responsibilities of bargaining members and giving them to non-union members, and conversely assigning union members non-bargaining unit work. Mr. Alinsky started to talk to her nicely about that. She ignored him. He continued to press that issue. He filed numerous grievances. He raised it at labor management meetings. He raised it at health and safety committee meetings. She complained about that. She not only complained to Mr. Rossi and Warden Polk, she also complained to a nurse in that unit that Malinsky was being mean to her by complaining about these issues. When he was removed from those...
But you're wandering off the point. This last argument that the defendant makes is that he would have had his office moved regardless of any of these animosities, right? They say it was to free up his second move. It was to free up space for telepsychiatry services and health care.
There remained vacant offices in that unit after he was moved. And this is kind of the classic reason why summary judgment is not appropriate in this case. There are contested issues of fact. If we read Alinsky's briefs and read the briefs of the defendants, what we come up to is essentially glorified closing arguments. I think Judge Kadahy got it right. This is one of those cases which is better left to a jury to decide.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Baker and Mr. Siegel. We'll move to our next case, GEA.